If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What happened to you if you were captured in battle in the Middle Ages? Well, that's the subject of today's conversation. Medieval historian Remy Amble has investigated the experiences of prisoners of war during the Hundred Years' War, a series of conflicts that were fought in the 14th and 15th centuries. Our content director, David Musgrove, put in a call to him to find out more.
Today's interview is going to be a good one. I'm joined by Dr. Remy Amble, who is a lecturer in medieval history at the University of Southampton. His work has focused on politics and ethics of war in the 14th and 15th century in France, England, and Burgundy. And one of the most illuminating lines of his research is on prisoners of war in the Hundred Years' War. He's written a book on the topic, which is called Prisoners of War in the Hundred Years' War, Ransom Culture in the Late Middle Ages, along with several journal articles on it too. And that is the subject we're going to chat about today. So, Remy, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm perfectly fine. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Right. So the first thing we need to do before we can start talking about this subject is just to get a little bit of a sense about the topic we're talking about. So could you please just give us a super quick sketch of the Hundred Years' War? Just give us the dates of start and finish and a little bit of context about what's going on.
So the Hundred Years' War is one of the longest conflicts in history, and it lasts actually more than 100 years, so 116 years. It starts in 3037 and ends in 4053. At the origin lies two overlapping issues. One is called the feudal issues, which is a problem of land that the English king holds in France since the Norman conquest of England in 1066. These lands are held as fief, so the English king is also a vassal of the French king for the lands he holds in France. And these lands are the Duchy of Aquitaine. And this has become a problem between the two kings because the French king has a power of justice over the Duchy of Aquitaine. So basically can interfere in the business of the English king ruling Aquitaine in France. This has been an issue for during the 50 years before the Hundred Years' War and has raised several conflicts which had not lasted. They stopped quite quite short conflict. What happened with the Hundred Years' War is that there is this overlapping issue of the dynastic issues. The English king claims the throne of France, and he makes this claim on the basis of a claim he had from his mother Isabella. So he elevates his status of rebellious vassal of the French king as a rival. He put himself on an equal footing, claiming that he is the rightful king of France. So this is the origin of the war, and the reason why it lasts 100 years, because once he has claimed to be the king of France, he could not possibly settle on anything less than being the king of France. So it's usually divided into phases. The first phase, the 14th century phases, is made of big English expeditions in France. They are called the chevauchées, these horse riding raids in France. And this gives place in the 15th century to more a war of conquest and settlement. And the most striking treaty is the Treaty of Troyes, which makes the English king, Henry V, becoming heir of the French kingdom. So, as I said, it's becoming more a war of a conquest and pacification of a kingdom of France which belonged to the English king. It will end up, and all ends in the mid-15th century, so Charles VII resume war in 1449, and the reconquest lasts about 5 years, and the English are eventually expelled from the Duchy of Aquitaine and the Duchy of Normandy, which they had conquered 30 years before.
Okay, thank you. So a good potted history there. It's clearly a complicated story of lots and ups and downs, lots of famous battles, Poitiers, Crecy, Agincourt, the Treaty of Troyes, as you said, in 1420. So lots of undulating fortunes for both sides. And there were a lot of bloody episodes within this conflict. Now, what we want to talk about today is prisoners of war and their role and place in this story. You've done some very interesting research on it. So let's start off by talking about some of the examples. You've identified numerous examples, I think over 60 of people who were taken prisoner in battle during this long conflict. And your research has unearthed the first documented example of an English prisoner of war from 1357. Is that right?
Not totally. I mean, the
okay.
the number of prisoners that I've found out is the number of prisoners of war which are explicitly called prisonniers de guerre. So the French phrase prisonnier de guerre. This doesn't mean that there are no more prisoners of war. There are quite a lot of prisoners of war. It's just that the phrase originates from the Hundred Years' War, and more specifically towards the beginning, you alluded to it, the Battle of Poitiers, 1356. It's where it's the first mention of the prisonnier de guerre. So why it's interesting and important is that I started to trace this origin of the French phrase, because the French phrase also has modeled the English phrase and the Italian phrase, as if it was spreading across Europe and it originating in France. So it's becoming quite intriguing, interesting to see if the phrase is linked with the emergence of a new status. And it's what in my last part of my research, I try to study what can we learn from the origin of a French of this French phrase. But the thing I need to be careful when I say that, because and it's quite a catchy title which attract public attention, to say the first prisoner of war, which is misleading. I haven't discovered the first prisoner of war. I have discovered, maybe somebody will find another reference earlier, but I believe that I have firm ground to say that I've discovered the origin of the phrase, the first prisoner of war, who is actually called prisonnier de guerre, so has the phrase prisonnier de guerre attributed to him.
Brilliant. That's very clear. Thank you. So just taking that back a bit, I mean, clearly there were prisoners of war before 1357. As you said, clearly people were taken prisoner and captive during conflicts. So we need to go back a little bit, I think, and try and understand, is there something different that's happening in the Hundred Years' War as opposed to the experience of people captured in conflict prior to the mid-14th century?
Well, I think Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that the status of prisoner of war is tightly associated with the practice of ransoming. And his status derives from the economic value of the prisoner. So he has rights because he has a value. And this is fundamental to understand the logic of the ransom culture in that time, that they are interlinked. And this originates, there are several studies about that, which place the origin of the ransoming culture in the 10th century, again in northern France, and which has since spread with the aristocratic diaspora in Europe and the conquest, the crusades, or the conquest of England, and so forth. So it's this this status of prisoner of war through the ransoming culture, through the fact that they have a value and they can be set free through the payment of a ransom, has been associated with the most important element of chivalry. Okay, so it has spread and in the Hundred Years' War, it's becoming. We have evidence, and especially at the Battle of Poitiers, of really big bulk of prisoners who are captured. So it's the number of prisoners which makes the difference. There are prisoners of war taken and ransomed within Anglo-Norman conflicts before the Hundred Years' War, between the 11th and the 14th century. But you have this bulk of prisoners taken in the Hundred Years' War.
And was it, your research may not extend back beyond the 11th century, but presumably when there were Vikings versus Anglo-Saxons, and there was a sort of a Christian pagan element in conflict going on, presumably ransoming was less of a thing there, and people were just enslaved and had a very
exactly maimed, enslaved, killed. That's what was the fate of prisoners of war. The fate of prisoner, if they were taken, before this rise of the ransoming culture.
Okay, so this idea of the rise of chivalry and this chivalric idea, it's part of this sense of civilizing the aristocracy, isn't it? That's the general trend that historians have identified, that it's part of just making the life of the aristocratic classes in medieval Europe slightly better and slightly less risky if they went to war. Is that a reasonable summation of where we're at?
Yes, no, this is absolutely right.
Okay. So within that, then, that means that rules and laws have to be developed if that's going to be something that's of practical value. So at what point do we begin to see actual rules of engagement here that relating to prisoners of war? Is it from 1356, or are there things earlier than that?
Well, you have the most formal code is called the Law of Arms, which is used by contemporaries. Contemporaries don't talk about laws of war, but they talk about the Law of Arms, or in French, the droit des armes, in Latin, the jus armorum. This is their law. And you can see it already applies in the 12th, 13th century, but mostly the problem is a problem of sources. You don't know exactly, we don't have much detail about them until the 14th, 15th century, where we have plenty of documentation, not only through narrative sources, but also through legal suits, administrative records, financial records. They all mention this law of arms and give actually some specifics about it. And it's quite fascinating to see that you have two tiers in terms of the law of arms. You have the law of arms we talk about. You were talking about the civilization of chivalry in chronicle sources. According to the law of arms, such and such prisoner should be treated fairly, have courteous prison, should not be ransomed too highly. This is one picture in the chronicle. When you look now, and this is quite fascinating about the 14th, 15th century, you look at these administrative records, you look at this legal suit. When they talk about the ransom of the law of arms, it's purely practical and pragmatic and self-interested. Legal suits don't talk about humanity, about fair treatment. They talk about the claim, the right claim to the ransom of a prisoner. The disputes are over the ransom of prisoner. The disputes are over the ownership of prisoners. And there you have an amazing amount of rules according to which one need to abide if you want to have this ownership of the prisoner. But the killing of prisoners in court is never blamed in terms you should not have, you are a Christian and killed a Christian. It's debated in terms you need to compensate the person who prisoners who was the master of the prisoner.
Okay, so if the rules and the laws are, as you say, entirely based on economy and economic and property ownership values, then presumably that means that the basis of them would apply to an aristocratic person as much as a low-born archer.
Okay, so yeah, that's a very interesting question. I mean, the I would not say that there is no principle, more civil principle about the law of arms. It's just that it's not discussed in the in the court cases, in the administrative. It's not the reality of war. The Chronicle put a gloss on it. But I do have mentioned, you have sometimes mentioned about fair treatment in other records. But you're right. I mean, coming back to what you were saying, these rules are in the records I've been using. So I've been mainly concentrating, gone out beyond the Chronicle sources, and too many studies have been stuck with these narrative sources. When you go beyond, you see rules which spread beyond the knightly community, and especially in the 14th, 15th century, because at that time the armies enrolled soldiers which were no more of knightly status. You can see this practice of ransoming spreading lower down the social hierarchy of the army. But this is a difficult issue also, which needs to be thought out properly, because you have one problem. If it's an economic value which is the basis of the status of the prisoner of war, you need the prisoner to be solvent, to be able to pay the ransom. So there are a lot of issues which can raise if you are ransoming a lower-ranking soldier, an archer. So what I can't say, it's exactly how it works. What I can say, it's that indeed they put something into places. And what indicates that? It's from the Agincourt and in the 15th century, especially in the 15th century, you have, when you look at a bulk of prisoners taken, you can see that the amount of the ransoms for the really the lower down of the hierarchy, you have a scale of prices, the several occurrences of the same price in this bulk of ransoms you have. So that there is a kind of systematization of, a system is put into place. So which you can assume it's the prices are fixed according to some form of function the soldiers had in the army. When you go higher up the hierarchy, you can see that there is no such systematization. It's down to individuals, a count, a barons, higher ranking knights. It's negotiated individually and estimated individually their ransom.
So based presumably on what their assets and their chattels were worth, rather than on any martial ability. It's not based on, you know, this guy was an amazing fighter, so he's worth twice as much as someone else. It's about how much money they've got back home to pay a ransom.
Well, what the captors think they are worth, because mostly nobody knows. Even the king of France doesn't know exactly what are all the assets of his nobility. So you can imagine the enemy. So it's most about projection and what people imagine. As well, you were talking about reputation. Reputation can play, can contribute to increase the ransom, especially if you think that the king of France or a king or a high a prince will want to pay the ransom of the knight. So if the ransom, if the knight is a very valorous and has a big reputation, it can increase the amount of the of his ransom. So yes, so you have this. It's always a bit intriguing so to wonder how on earth they can assess this amount. They make this estimate about the ransom of the soldier, of the prisoner. And you can also imagine the amount of pressure that can be put on the prisoner to accept to pay a higher ransom.
Okay. And for these rules and laws to operate sensibly, they must have had to have been applied equally on both sides of on the French and English side. So was there an agreement that there was these laws were like a universal construct for both sides to operate under?
Well, it's you can talk about international law, the law of arms. It's kind of you can compare that to a private. International law which apply to the knights and also to the lower down the hierarchy. So yes, and you can see that through ordinances of war as well, which are used by the kings when they go to war, and which are cried before a battle. These set the rules, and you can see that the rules are comparable to the treaties on chivalry and on the way to wage war. They are comparable. They are inspired by the customs. So. There is a consensus that a tacit consensus that the same rules apply, and I think the best regulator for taming violence is the principle of retaliation. You know that, and this is argued sometimes in sources, is that if you kill a prisoner, the enemy will kill his prisoner too. And I think this is a principle which is not just about the Hundred Years' War, but in terms of conducting war, it's a much bigger, much more important, this principle in setting the rules.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But you also read about prisoners being thrown into dungeons, pits, being fettered, shackled, tortured. But you don't hear much about them. And the problem is, you don't hear about these people because, firstly, the voice of the lower-ranking people in general do not really emerge in the primary sources we have, and also because the prisoners who die have no voice at all.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Can we try and just drill into the practicalities of how this process might have happened a bit? And I don't know how far you know this from the sources you've been able to study, but going into the battlefield, so there's a bloody conflict going on. Do we know how somebody would actually be taken captive? How might it have worked?
Okay, this is one of the slightly mystery. it's a bit complicated, but we can read through sources that there are some rules which can help the system to work, which is to you can read in places that touching the right hand and asking for ransom can be taken as a sign and a gesture that would be understood as in the heat of the action as the prisoner, as the soldier giving up and handing himself over to his enemy. There are, yes, words and gesture which have been highlighted in the sources, which must have applied and helped to take the prisoners in situation of battle. But it's still quite tricky to understand how it was, because you also have, when the prisoner have given his hand, you have his life in your hand, and you are supposed to protect the life of the prisoner at that point. So you need to take him outside of the battle, outside of the heat of the action. This is problematic. If you are in a melee, right in the combat, how does that happen? So you can hear, you can read sometimes that valets are there and to help the knights, and they take the prisoners and they will keep the prisoners outside the heat of the action. There are also other rules, and that becomes very interesting, because these are rules which are made to avoid the neutralization of the knights on the battlefield. Is that once you have taken your prisoner, you take the word of the prisoner and you take a token which proves that you have captured these prisoners, like a gauntlet or the sword. And this would be evidence in a debate after the battle that he is your prisoner. And then you can go on fighting. Or you keep, and if the prisoners you've taken is put aside and his life is not in danger, that's a prerequisite. But you can go on fighting, and there are other rules which helped again the combatants to go on fighting. Is that you can, if the prisoner is found on the battlefield and with no security, and if somebody else found him, sometimes there are rules which share the ransoms between the new captor and the former captor. And then you have plenty of disputes after battle, because people are claiming I took him, but I took him after because he was left on the battlefield. So plenty of confusion.
It's a complicated bit, and it's quite hard to imagine how that would work, isn't it? As you say, in a melee, obviously I've never fought in a 15th century battle, but my imagining is that it's a pretty busy, lively affair. And to have somebody sort of saying, holding their hand up and then being escorted off to sit on the sideline seems quite unlikely, doesn't it? But there must have been, as you say, there must have been some mechanism for that to happen. So.
I think in terms, we focus on battles, but a lot of prisoners are taken outside situation of battles. What you can hear, you can read in the documents is that, and you can imagine this is the place where the prisoners are taken, is once the victory is secured on the battlefield, there starts the hunt, the chase of the prisoners, the chase of the defeated. And it is at that point that it becomes very dangerous in terms of casualties. You kill a lot of people like that. And you also captured a lot of prisoners. And actually, it's always been a very tricky business for the commanders, the military commanders, to deal with this permission to take prisoners, because you can imagine how it can challenge the victory on the battlefield. So sometimes you have orders which are given by the commanders at the start that prisoners can be taken only once victory is plainly and obviously secured on the battlefield. And these ordinances, I have evidence of them, and I don't know if I can make the link, but I think I'm really tempted to make it. I have two evidence of ordinances set which set this clause. It's in 1417 and 1423. And you have references of this kind of thinking before, but what I found striking is that you have this evidence is this set of ordinances just after Agincourt, because at Agincourt, obviously, everybody knows about it, prisoners were taken massively on the battlefield in the melee, but then the French rear guard was about to launch a last assault, and Henry V ordered the prisoners to be killed. So I wonder if you can make a link between this new clause in the ordinances in 1417, 1423 with the memory and of the disaster of Agincourt, and they didn't want that to happen again.
So is what you're saying that the very fact that it was possible that prisoners could be taken, did that change the way battles were conducted, change the way that leaders approach battles and their tactics and strategy, I suppose?
Well, yeah, yes, I think they need to take that into account. But in the development of tactics, I mean, when you read about the narrative of the battle, which we mostly know about tactic and strategy through narrative sources, and they are not always very well informed. It's quite difficult to make sense of things, how things happen. When you read about that, they don't talk mostly about prisoners. You don't know how they include that into their tactics. When you read the ordinances, which, as I said, were supposed to be issued before the battle and cried, you can hear that they try to minimize the impact of the ransom business, but they never really completely suppress it. It's rare. At the beginning of the Hundred Years' War, the Battle of Crécy, apparently there was a no quarter ordered issued on the French side, and then it was echoed by the English side. No prisoners would be taken. And evidence about prisoners taken at Crécy are very little evidence, actually. So it mostly applied. But from the Battle of Poitiers in 1356 onwards, you don't have that kind of order. And when prisoners are killed on the battlefield, it's because of emergency situation like Agincourt.
Okay, that's interesting. So sort of going back into the detail a little bit, do we know very much about the immediate experience of a captured soldier after a battle? Presumably they were in quite a dangerous and unpleasant situation at that stage.
Yes. So you mean after the capture, what happened to them until they are ransomed? So as I said, mostly the aim is to derive a profit. Sometimes you also have exchange of prisoners, or if they can't pay their ransom, they are not necessarily killed. They could as well, or rot in prison, they could as well start to serve or to change allegiance or to serve their master in another way. So it's, as you say, it must be a very tricky situation, especially if you are not a prince or somebody of really higher ranking status. Prisoners are the property of the master. So the prisoners are in charge. The keeping of the prisoners is in the responsibility of the master. So if the host is traveling through enemy countries, he needs to keep and to make sure that prisoner does not escape and stay with him. And afterwards, he needs to find a lodgment. You find them a bit everywhere in the gates of towns, in some prisons of towns, or they are kept in a house. They are kept castles for when you look at obviously the prisoners of higher aristocratic status who are taken to England. A lot of French spend quite a lot of time in quite beautiful residence there. But you also read about prisoners being thrown into dungeons, pits, being fettered, shackled, tortured. But you don't hear much about them. And the problem is you don't hear about these people because, firstly, the voice of the lower-ranking people in general do not really emerge in the primary sources we have. And also because the prisoners who die have no voice at all. So it's actually quite tricky to see and fully grasp the bleak future, the bleak situation in which they were. I have one interesting reference of which is quite bleak, of one man who was hired as a torturer in a garrison. He was meant to extract the biggest ransom possible from the prisoner, for them to agree at the biggest possible ransom, so and to torture them if they did not.
Crikey, that's unpleasant. Okay, so conditions in which captives were held could have varied quite substantially, but presumably sometimes they could have been quite expensive or quite a burden on the person who's the master. Was that expense kind of expected to be borne by the prisoner at some point? Was it added to the ransom, or was that was it just a cost that was an accepted part of the process?
It's actually in the sources. It's a big issue. The costs are meant to be covered by the master of the prisoner until he pays the ransom, and then you have calculation made to cover which include the time he has spent in captivity. So it's an added price to the ransom, and you can see that this is set as a percentage of the ransom for the lower ranking prisoner, especially in the 15th century, which makes one think that the system is working very efficiently there, because you don't want the prisoner to spend too much money and spend more than the percentage which is allotted to the captivity of the prisoner. So yes, it's a very regulated system.
And then, okay, so let's move on a bit, and let's assume that a ransom has been agreed through torture or some other mechanism. So that the ransom has been agreed, the person who is captive has the means to pay. How does the money actually get transferred? How does a process like that work in the Middle Ages?
What we know is that a lot of prisoners actually raised the funds themselves. What happened, and it's mostly for prisoners of higher status, is that they are released on parole. They give the parole that they would come back to their prison with the amount of their ransom. And instead of them are put in prisons hostages. And the favorite hostage is the son, the heir of the prisoner. Or sometimes the wife, or sometimes you can see heralds who enjoy some form of immunity of war, playing a part in putting into connection the prisoner from his prison and the family and the connection of the prisoners outside the prison to raise the money. But mostly it is a private business, and the prisoners are by themselves. They are responsible to pay for their own time, and they can't expect from the king to pay for the ransom. It's their responsibility. And the king would only help his family and possibly members of his household, or sometimes when he has interest in a particular individual. So, yes, it's working with this system of hostages, and as well, extra guarantee are taken by the master in terms of pledges. So people would act as pledge several other soldiers or lords or friends would act as pledge and promise to pay or themselves to become prisoner if they don't pay instead of the prisoner, if the prisoner default.
Okay, you made a very interesting point just then about the moral obligation or otherwise of the monarch to do anything about these ransoms. So basically, you're saying there's no moral or presumably legal obligation for the king to do anything about the circumstance of these ransomed these hostage prisoners, even though they were fighting for that monarch. That's, you know, they were in that king's service. So, but there's no. There's no comeback there.
No, I think what you need to understand is these combatants fight in the Middle Ages and the armies of the Hundred Years' War as individuals, and rights are secured by them as by them and against them, and their duties are secured by and against them as individuals. They are not. It's not a state matter. So. You can quite understand that with the system of prisoner of war, because the king allows to gain money from the ransom. So when you are taken, you have the misfortune to be taken prisoner, you need to pay for your ransom. And actually this whole private ransom business, the English king derives a profit from it. He levies a taxation on ransoms. So it's a system which shows the extent to which individual combatants fight as individuals and not as under the responsibility of the state. And as well, how officialized it is and how the state derives profit from the situation.
Okay. I think when I was reading one of your articles, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but there were some occasions that you found of individuals being ransomed or having their ransoms paid by groups of their friends or peers in their army or army units or whatever they were fighting. Is that true? Were some people basically ransomed by their friends? And if so, what does that tell us about medieval friendship and band of brothers in the Middle Ages, if that's a thing?
Yes, this is true. You can have, I think the best example is in the late Middle Ages in 1454. You have an example where Charles VII asks for all the captains to sacrifice a part of their pay to ransom the prisoners, their fellow captains who were taken prisoners. But it's an initiative of the crown. Initiative of captains and friends, you don't have many evidence. It's mostly family. In terms of captains and the fellow combatants, you have, you mentioned the brother in arms, you have actually the contract, one evidence of a contract of brotherhood in arms. And in this contract, this is a fascinating document, a contract made by two esquires when they are quite new to the business of war. They are arriving in France in 1421 and they seal a contract by which they promise to help each other in case of them being ransomed, and they promise to share the profits if they manage to take prisoners. You have a lot of these associations throughout the Hundred Years' War. The problem is that it's not often that you see this, that these associations are really promoting solidarity between them. It's more associations which are made on the spot in particular circumstances to share the profits, but it's about greed there and about to make sure that you will have your share of the profits. It's far less evidence about the share of the problems which comes with the being captured and to pay the ransom. Not the risk. You don't share the risks.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you so much for that. So our listeners can find out a bit more about this by looking for your journal articles, but that would require access to learned journals. But you have your book, which is available, and your thesis is accessible online, I see. And there are a couple of articles on the BBC website that report on some of your lines of research. Dr. Remy Amboul from the University of Southampton, thank you very much for your time.
That was Remy Amboul from the University of Southampton. His book, Prisoners of War in the Hundred Years' War, is published by Cambridge University Press. You can also read a feature on Remy's research on our website at historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next on Friday when Guy Bowman will be discussing the forgotten Muslim soldiers of Dunkirk.